This week, Netflix released Conversations with a Killer, the Charles Manson tapes, in which I'm featured. Now, I've been a part of this documentary project with Joe Berlinger and his team for nearly 2 years, and I'm very excited to see it come out, and being a part of it is such an honor. It's a career highlight. So today, I wanted to react to the documentary, but I didn't want to do it alone, so I've called George Stimson. If you've never heard of George Stimson and you're interested in the Charles Manson case, you need to find out who he is. George Stimson knew Manson probably better than almost anyone else. He spent decades visiting him in prison, spent hundreds of hours talking to him in person and on the phone, and he wrote the book Goodbye Helter Skelter, which is a rebuttal to Vincent Bugliosi's Helter Skelter. And outside of his journalistic endeavors, George Stimson's life partner is Sandra Good, also known as Blue, who remains one of Manson's most ardent supporters. I featured Sandra and others in my documentary, Charles Manson, The Women, which you can still find on Peacock. In this conversation, George and I discuss our reactions to the newly released series, Conversations with a Killer, The Charles Manson Tapes. So, George, how long did you know Manson? I know you spent an enormous amount of time with him.
Yeah, I started actually communicating with him and seeing him in 1991. So from that on and off, I was pretty much in constant communication with him until 2001. I visited him in Corcoran almost 200 times and spoke to him on the phone hundreds of times. So, and then there was a gap between 2001 and about 2015 where we didn't talk to each other. But then after that, we got back together and were in contact with each other until he died in 2017.
And I've met probably 100 people involved in the Manson case over the years. And I consider you to be, if not the foremost expert on these matters, one of the foremost experts on these matters. You're incredibly knowledgeable. Your book is must read, in my opinion, if you are interested in the Manson case. You watched the documentary, Conversations with a Killer, the Charles Manson tapes, in which I appear. I watched it as well. And just for our audience, so they know, I saw it on Wednesday when it came out on Netflix. That was the first time I had ever seen it.
Okay.
So this is fresh to me as well. What was your overall opinion of it?
On Wednesday too.
Yeah, you watched it on Wednesday. What was your overall opinion of it?
You know, I was kind of surprised, but not surprised how much it was the same old, same old. I have some stuff to go over, but basically, you know, I kind of had an idea when they said they didn't want to talk to me that they didn't want to get too far afield from the standard narrative. And there was one thing that they did kind of change, that they are changing, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But pretty much it was the, you know, the same old thing. And, you know, I kind of wondered why they were doing it. I guess they had some kind of tag. I don't know who's those secret lost tapes or whatever they were. I don't know who they were from. Did you know who they were from? I mean, some of them were from other shows like Geraldo and other sources, but
yeah, I don't have insight in that. I noticed in the first episode, they do seem to have some sort of tapes of Manson. It sounds more recent in his voice. I'm just guessing. And in the second episode, they do have some tapes as well. There are very few tapes, actually, and as you say, a lot of the audio, especially in the second episode and the third episode, I recognized as Dateline, Tom Snyder, Diane Sawyer, like all those kind of infamous interviews he's done. But no, I don't know where the tapes came from or what tapes they used. Okay. I don't have any insight there. But I agree to a point. I actually thought overall it was fairly balanced for a very mainstream, you know, Charles Manson documentary series, except in the treatment of the family themselves. That was kind of the issue I took with it. But I'm really interested to hear your insight. Let's dive into it more. What was something that you thought they got right, they got wrong?
Well, I'll just go over what I have here.
Yeah, please.
You know, generally, I didn't think the representation of Charlie. I know they always show him with long hair and a beard, and never considered that he was clean shaven and had football and went back and forth and had 100 different looks. But I suppose they do that just so the viewer doesn't get too confused.
Yes, this is something I noticed as well. They portray Manson as kind of with long hair and a big beard the entire.
And sometimes they even have him in prison blues.
You know, right.
And the shirt.
So. And especially, this is something when you're making a documentary about Manson. Manson looked dramatically different in 1967, 1968. He didn't look anything like what we picture when we think of Charles Manson nowadays. That look with the swastika and the the long hair and the beard, that came years later. And actually, I noticed on the poster for Conversations with a Killer, they have used the mugshot from his Barker Ranch arrest, and the filmmakers have drawn an X on his forehead. I don't know if you've noticed this, maybe to make it more.
I didn't see that. But, you know, I didn't care for that. I thought they had him. I didn't like the way they had him dressed. It was not that's an aesthetic thing, but I didn't like what they had him wearing. I didn't like the actors altogether. You know, I thought that I can understand you have to have reenactments, but I think they could have had him without so much emphasis on the face of the the actors and then showing them next to the real people. It was confusing and unnecessary. They didn't really look like them. So that was another thing that was off-putting to me. They had too much emphasis on the actors and the reenactments. Another thing, I can just go down the list here, but
sure.
They had Stephanie Schramm, and I think they represented her as being at the ranch for a much longer period of time than she actually was. She got there the day of the murders at the Polanski residence and was there until she ran away in the desert a month or so later. But they made it sound like she had been at Spahn Ranch the whole time and it was there for a longer period of time than she was. At least that's the impression I got of it. I don't know if I'm going to watch it again to verify all this, and somebody can correct me.
Let me just jump in there for a second, George, because this is something I very much noticed. I felt the most inaccurate part of the documentary was the depiction of the Manson family from 1967, 1968, up until shortly before the murders began,
right.
That was 69. And in that period, I kept asking myself, why is this so inaccurate? They're getting the timeline wrong. They're saying things happened in 67, 68 that I know happened in 69 or 70 or later, you know. And then I realized, to your point, the entire first episode, the entire depiction of the Manson family is told from the perspective of Stephanie Schramm, who was Manson's girlfriend, who was only with the family for about a month
yeah.
In 1969. Diane Lake, who was only 14 at the time and was very marginalized in the kind of Manson community. And her recollection is good on some things, but when it comes to kind of the murders themselves and Manson's ideology or she's poor on that. She's an unreliable narrator.
Right.
And then the final person they had was Catherine Scher Gypsy, who was there for a significant amount of the time.
Yeah.
And I actually thought her recollection was the most accurate. But I mm-hmm. think what I bumped on was the fact that they were kind of portraying the Manson family from the women, from the perspective of two women who really were outside and one of whom was not even there. So I did think the timeline, the depiction of the Manson family up until the summer of 1969 was manipulated and quite overdramatic.
Yeah, I also didn't like it when they showed the family supposedly at gatherings or whatever they were, having all these beer bottles and bottles of liquor around, like they're all partying in a fraternity house or something. You know, when sure, they did LSD and marijuana and hallucinogens and things like that, but they weren't these, the college kids quaffing, they were just beer bottles all over the place when they showed the thing. And that was totally inaccurate and misrepresentation of what their lifestyle was, because they were not into that self-destructive, behavior. A lot of their parents were already alcoholics, so they knew about that. Another thing that they didn't do, and this was in the last episode of the trial, and this is very important, they didn't mention the fact that he was denied his pro per right to defend himself, because that was such an important thing to him personally, because he went on about it for decades and decades until the very end, that he never had the right to defend himself. So they just didn't explain that. They just said the defense rested, and that was the end of that. So that was a big issue that they didn't bring up at all.
And let me jump in there, George. There's two issues with the trial that I took issue with. Three things I want to say about the trial. One, they did not say Susan, the entire prosecution was dependent on Susan Atkins' testimony. And the reason she didn't testify was because she was sabotaged by Linda Kasabian and her attorney in the prison. They didn't mention that at all. All they said was, oh, she just didn't want to testify. They ignored the fact that there was kind of this conspiracy to stop her from testifying.
Mm-hmm.
They also, like you said, they said they portrayed the defense as essentially Manson testifying outside the jury, and then that was it. There was no other defense. But there was a long, robust defense of Manson, and there was many legal issues, like you said, of his desire to represent himself that was turned down, the death of Leslie Van Houten's attorney, which isn't even mentioned. You know, there's many, many legal aspects to the defense that they just brushed over completely.
Yeah.
And the third thing I wanted to mention about the trial was that the prosecution had to use a novel argument that wouldn't hold up anymore. And that's this idea of vicarious liability to convict Manson. So they acted as if the helter skelter was the legal means by which they convicted him, which it wasn't.
Right. Well, yeah, you mentioned that. I kind of noticed that people are starting to totally disbelieve the helter-skelter motive, and they're going over and getting in line with the copycat motive, but they're still saying that Manson masterminded that. So even though, you know, it wasn't the motive that they gave in court, he's still the mastermind. And I haven't really sat down and researched everything to see how that would play out. Maybe I'll do another podcast on that, but to see whether he's as suddenly the mastermind of the get Bobby out of jail thing. I'd have to look at the timeline where he was when things happened. I haven't had time to do that. But I did notice they kind of blew off the helter-skelter motive and spent more time explaining that it was the copycat killings to get Bobby out of jail, which on one hand is good, but the way they did it was not good.
That is interesting, and I did pick up on that even though they clearly debunk the helter-skelter narrative, which I very much appreciated, they still, and this is in every Manson documentary ever made, they still have to tie Manson in somehow. He still has to want to be a rock star. He still has to be obsessed with the Beatles.
He's still guilty.
Yeah, even though that has really nothing to do with anything, he still thought there was going to be a race war, you know, we're going to debunk that and say that's not true.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned that the rock star thing, you know, they're still peddling that myth that's been long ago debunked when Terry Melcher went out to the ranch to record Manson in the summer of 1969. He testified that I said to Manson, "I can't get you into a recording studio unless you join a union." And Manson said, "I'm not joining any unions." Now, that doesn't sound to me like somebody who's obsessed with a career in show business. Somebody obsessed would have said, "Where do I join? How much does it cost?" So clearly Manson rejected show business offers and not vice versa. But they're still puddling it. And even, you know, when you hear Manson's music and think about him, the whole concept of a, quote, rock and roll star is kind of farcical. You know, he does play music, but it's not really rock and roll by any, you know, stretch of the imagination.
Definitely folk. And to build on that, the idea that Manson wanted to be a rock star comes up over and over again. To your point, you know, he had an opportunity with Terry Melcher that he turned down. He did record music with Phil Kaufman that he refused to release. Manson was offered a opening spot with the Beach Boys, which he turned down because he was on parole. There's many, many, many instances, anecdotes, times you can point to where Manson had a clear opportunity to advance himself in the music industry and turned it down because he wasn't interested in contracts and money. And he was much more interested in just, you know, living within the commune and just kind of surviving.
And doing his music.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So
yeah, that's good. I'm glad you picked up on that too. But I mean, they're still puddling the same old thing, you know, that he wanted to be a rock star. Another thing, they've got Jeff Gwynn in there, who's not the most sympathetic author of any Manson, but saying that Manson was in on the Crow ripoff from the very beginning, when I think the evidence points to that. That was Tex Watson's idea, and that Charlie did get dragged into it accidentally and have to deal with it. And it was not a "you do this and I'll do this" kind of thing. You know, a lot of these issues that I'm talking about now, I've already covered in my own podcast, and, you know, debunking that Charlie was involved with Crow from the beginning and the other things about the music career. It's kind of discouraging to see the same thing over and over again. Like had Ivor Davis chiming in and having say, "He was only 5'2". And it's like, come on, that's like saying he's 6'2", you know? It's just the same old stuff over and over again.
Let me ask you about the Lots of Papa thing, because I actually did notice this. In conversations with the killer, Jeff Gwynn, he makes an offhanded comment and he says something to the effect of Manson and Tex came up with the idea to burn a drug dealer. And the documentary on Gwynn never mentioned that Tex was actually working with another woman who I've spoken with, Rosina Kroner. And they actually planned the drug deal. Tex had a girlfriend outside the Manson family at this time, and it was right. them who did the drug deal. And she's talked about this before. This is not disputed.
Right.
But Jeff Gwynn makes the offhanded comment, yes, Manson and Tex plotted this drug deal to right. burn Lots of Papa. I'd actually never heard anyone say that before, like connect Manson to... You've heard this before? I hadn't. That was the first time I'd ever heard anyone frame it that way. That Manson had somehow.
You know, I have heard that he was that. Yeah, I'm going to have to remember where I heard it. But yeah, I've definitely heard that before. Oh, I know. I think it's in Tex's book. He says we had already agreed that he would take care of this.
And oh, it's in Tex's book. That makes
when,
sense.
When yeah. Crow called the ranch, Tex says, "Oh, we had already agreed that you know Charlie would handle this part of it. You know, when I rip the guy off and he comes after you." Ready to kill you, will you handle that part of it? Does that sound like a good deal to you?
Right.
Well,
right.
I don't think Charlie would have anything to do with that, and it doesn't make sense that anybody would, really.
No,
that
and how...
A little anger somebody so much, and don't worry, I'll take care of it, no problem.
Yeah. And Lots of Papa testified at the trial and never said anything about Manson wanting to rip him off. In fact, what I always thought was the interesting part of the story was that when Lots of Papa calls Spahn Ranch, he asks for Charles because Tex and Charles Manson have the same
right.
name. And that's
right.
how he gets Manson. And right. I always thought that was an interesting irony. But it's not, yeah, it is not portrayed in the documentary that way. But
you've read Lots of Papa's testimony, I guess. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really think people should read trial testimonies as much as they can.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
there's so much hidden stuff in there that you don't get.
Well, and the fact that Lots of Papa had kidnapped a woman and was holding her. Ransom,
right.
like that's the reason yeah. that was the reason Charles Manson went over to his house was because Lots of Papa said I have a
and then he
wooden
says,
kidnap.
And then he says I never threatened to come out and kill the ranch, but at the same time he's saying that Rosina's on the phone threatening to come out and kill the ranch, and he's not saying anything like, no, I'm not. What are you talking about?
Right.
You know, he shifted the threat from him to her. You know, I guess he's covering his own ass, and that's fine. But you know,
mm-hmm.
You can see what's really going on. What I did want to talk about getting back to Gypsy.
Sure.
You know, she's in these a lot of times, and she kind of said at this after the crawl or whatever, is that things got a little bad, and that's when I decided to leave Manson. And she doesn't say anything about leaving Manson and hooking up with Kenny Como and holding up the Hawthorne sporting goods store. Which is one thing I really think somebody should ask her about, because they always frame that like, oh, they blame that on Charlie too. They said, oh, they were getting guns to hijack a plane and kill a passenger every hour until they let him out. They don't mention the fact that they had over 100 rifles in the van when the police came up. And my question would be, well, what was the real purpose of stealing over 100 rifles? You wouldn't need that many to hijack a plane. So
mm-hmm.
There's more going on to that connection between Gypsy and Kenny Como and the Hawthorne robbery than generally, you know, they just put it out as another murderous, you know, event that's going to happen to benefit Charles Manson. And I think there's a lot more to it than that. And I really wish somebody who interviews her would take the opportunity to ask her about the details of the Hawthorne robbery and what that was about, really.
So I have interviewed Gypsy before and have asked her about the Hawthorne robbery. It has never been on TV because they didn't use that portion of the interview in the documentary. I made a documentary called Manson the Women, which you were a part of.
Yes.
That was with Lynette Sandergood and Gypsy and Diane Lake. And we did talk about the Hawthorne robbery. We edited a piece on it. But just to put this in context for our audience, and this is definitely something I noticed in conversations with the killer, Catherine Cher Gypsy depicts herself as becoming disillusioned with the family right about the end of the trial. That's kind of how she frames it.
Right.
In reality, she was very, very devout throughout the trial. And afterwards, after the trial, she and Sandra Good and a couple of neo-Nazi men, they're neo-Nazis if I'm not mistaken, attempted to rob a supply store, an army supply store, steal hundreds of weapons, and got into a shootout with police, all in an attempt to obtain enough weapons to somehow hijack a plane or something of this nature and break Manson out of prison. So regardless of the details of that event, it demonstrates that Catherine Scherer was very devoted to Manson well into the time she was incarcerated. And in fact, she told me that she didn't begin to distance herself from Manson until years into her incarceration. So in the documentary, it is depicted as if she was kind of waking up or, you know, wanting to get out in the 1970s. But that misplaces it by a decade.
I want to correct one
more
thing there. You said that she was with Sandra Good when she held up the store. I think you mean Mary Brunner.
Excuse me. Yes. She was not with Sandra Good.
Didn't do that. She would have said something.
That's right.
I don't know the whole story about Cher's involvement with Kenny Como and how they turned over to him and whatever. That'd be something to look into. I just don't think that, that robbery was to benefit Charlie. There was something else going on.
Right. Okay. So that wasn't Manson. May not even have been involved in that.
I think that was totally post Manson. Has nothing to do with him, really. It has more to do with Catherine Cher and her character than where her head was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was involved in credit card fraud and mail fraud after that. So she didn't get suddenly squeaky clean after the trial.
Of course, yeah. That was the error there. I was interviewed quite extensively for the documentary. I was surprised how much of my interview they used. I was pleased. I thought they edited me well. I thought overall it was pretty good. I there was things I took issue with. I would probably take issue with any Manson documentary ever produced just because I know so much about the case. But I did appreciate the depiction of the murders. I felt they missed a few things, but I did appreciate in general how they were depicted. They do go to the usual lengths to kind of draw Manson in to the plot because if you've ever made a documentary about Manson, and I've made many, the problem you always have is once the murders begin, Manson kind of falls away. He's very much on the edge, and he doesn't do a lot. From a documentary standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint, you're following this character of Manson, and then when the murders happen, which are kind of the most infamous part of his story, he's not that much involved. So filmmakers have to make choices into how they depict him. And in this case, Joe Berlinger made the choice to kind of portray Manson as if he was kind of almost narrating what to do through Tex, I guess, like pulling Tex aside and saying, go do this, go do that. And I don't think it was that simple. It's something I've covered in my podcast many times. I'm sure you've covered it. It's such a complicated situation. There's so much nuance there that I'm not surprised that kind of defaulted to the easy way to portray it, which is to say Manson told them what to do.
Right.
But that definitely isn't the truth, because at trial, that was the problem, was that he never told them what to do. And that was the whole point of the trial, was how do you convict this guy for influencing people without directing them.
Without precisely breaking the law, actually.
Well, George, thank you so much. This was very insightful. And what's your podcast for the audience?
Oh, it's the Goodbye Helter Skelter podcast. It's named after my book, and you can see it on YouTube. It's also, I haven't caught up with Podbean and the other, venues it's on, but I've got 33 episodes. I cover basically go through my book chapter by chapter and present my take on the case and do some other things after that. I review some of the books about the case, the more famous books, Gwynn's book and Chaos by Tom O'Neill, and some miscellaneous things, taking closer looks at the evidence of the crime scene and trying to match it up with what really happened based on, you know, the physical evidence of the crime scene and compare it to testimony and try to figure out what's the truth. So the Goodbye Helter Skelter podcast, you can see it on YouTube.